We continue to ask some important questions as we go through the season of Advent. And today we're asking the question, what's under your tree? Ironically, yesterday, well, not ironically, coincidentally, I suppose, we did something yesterday, Laura and I and our son and his wife. We went and got our Christmas trees, believe it or not, and we saw Jaden. Jaden was working out there at the Christmas tree lot, so it's very appropriate today. I ran across a funny story about a real Christmas tree retailer who annually would set up shop on an empty lot in a city. And his customers were always coming to him complaining about the high cost of the Christmas trees. And he was really getting tired of defending the price of his trees. So he came up with kind of a snappy answer whenever someone questioned the price of his trees. Sure enough, a customer came along and asked the age-old question, how do you determine the price of your Christmas trees? And the lot owner replied, well, we count all the needles on the tree, and we divide by 1,000 to get the price. Now, it's time-consuming work because the number changes every day because needles fall off. Now, in the account of the incident I read, it says that the customer actually had to think about it for a moment before it finally the light bulb went on. He realized he was being kidded. Every December, I'm flooded with memories, some good and some not so good, of running our own Christmas tree growing operation in Selkirk, Ontario. It was called Murphy's Tree Farm. And years later, when we were in Toronto, Laura was still in the thick of things with Christmas trees because she worked at Sheridan Nurseries, not far from where we lived, and she would sell Christmas trees during December. And she would tell us about how she would haul these big things out to little compact cars and try and tie them on the roof. I used to go to Sheridan Nurseries to pick her up after work, and I'd wander around in that area where the Christmas trees were hung. And it was beautiful, and the smell was terrific. But beyond that, I could always tell by looking at those trees, could always sense the enormous work involved in growing them. Every year, every Christmas tree, fresh Christmas tree, represents 7 to 15 years of growth. It also represents hours of mowing and spraying and, of course, trimming. I'll tell you that I did not feel very festive in June. Trimming pine trees in 30 centigrade heat while deer flies circled my head trying to nip at me. And even over the years, I happened to stumble on a couple of skunks while mowing. Fortunately, it was only our dog who got the worst of it. But every spring, I was struck by the fact that as we planted anywhere up to 1,000 seedlings, we were engaged in an act of hope. Every tree seedling that went into the ground was planted with the hope that it would grow. And eventually, it would be suitable for someone's living room. You know, I'm sure, that not every seedling made it. Some died because of drought or the dryness of the summer. Some were eaten by rabbits and deer. Some succumbed to insect damage, most often ants, believe it or not. And occasionally, someone would come along and say, I like that tree. I want it in my yard, so we sold it to them as nursery stuff. Christmas trees, actually trees in general, mean a great deal to me. When I see a small seedling, especially when it's in the wild, I find myself quietly cheering it on, hoping that it will reach full maturity. I read somewhere that the definition of a person of hope is a person who goes out and plants a tree that they will never, ever sit under for shade. Along with every cultivated Christmas tree, every tree that's intentionally planted is planted in hope. The Bible also uses trees as a symbol and a metaphor for hope. Events in biblical days, nations, and even family genealogies were often described as trees. In fact, we still talk about our own lineage as a family tree. We even have an expression. When a child resembles one of their parents, we like to say what? The apple does not fall far from the tree. Even a stump in the ground, symbolizes hope. In Job chapter 14, in the face of that tremendous experience of suffering, when Job lost everything, including all his children, we find these amazing words in verses 7 to 9 about hope. If a tree is cut down, there is hope that it will sprout again and grow new branches, though its roots have grown old in the earth and its stump decays. At the scent of water, it may bud and sprout again with a new seedling. I've seen this phenomenon many times, especially out in the wild, although unfortunately it doesn't work with evergreens. Years ago, I was asked to be, as a member of the Haldeman Woodlot Owners Association, to go to the town of Dunnville and look at a woodlot that was being scheduled to be clear-cut. And as we moved through the bush, we happened upon the biggest clump of silver maple I have ever seen. I've still never seen one like it. It was a group of five trunks, each at least 2 feet in diameter, growing out of the same root. Now, it was clear to me that someone, some many years in the past, had gone through that bush and cut that silver maple tree down. However, several shoots came off that old stump, and therefore we have this magnificent clump of silver maple. In our Old Testament lesson today, Isaiah has picked up the imagery of new shoots coming from an old stump, although he has a grander reason than anyone before him. Isaiah was writing and speaking to the people of Israel when they were under occupation. They were being oppressed by the nation of Assyria. And Isaiah portrays the king of Assyria as a very arrogant man. And because of this, Isaiah says that God was going to bring judgment down on Assyria. Isaiah, in his writing, describes the powerful army of Assyria is like a vast forest. It's going to get clear cut. It's going to get chopped down. But once those trees are down, Isaiah says, there's going to be no new shoots come up. Instead, there's going to be a shoot come from a place Assyria never imagined. The Assyrians and many Israelites believed that the house of David was finished. It was done. It was gone. It's history. The people of Israel understood this. The people of Assyria understood this. And the people of Israel, they were just devastated. What's to become of us, they cried. Without the lineage of David, where was their identity as a people? Where is their hope? Even if Assyria is wiped out, the people of Israel believe we still don't have a future. Isaiah jumps right into the midst of that despair and he shouts, hold on a minute. Not so fast. Now, the Assyrian forest is gone. And yes, Jesse's lineage, David's kingly line, is but a stump. But look more carefully. That old stump of Jesse is not without life. Something's happening there. A new tender shoot, a new life is emerging from it. A new king is coming. A new king in the line of David. And not just a new king, but a completely different type of king. This new king doesn't care about the things that most kings care about. He doesn't care one whit about worldly aspirations. He doesn't care about accumulating wealth. He doesn't care about building armies. He doesn't care about political matters. All these things that David's family always cared about. And his coming was to be good news to everyone, not just Israel, everyone. His rule will be marked by qualities that we all long for, we all need in this world. The Spirit of God will be upon this new king. He will be the king of great understanding and wisdom. He will be able to see right through the false and misleading people of this world. He will defend the poor. He will defend the exploited. He will rule against the wicked. He will destroy them with his very breath, Isaiah says. Even nature itself will reflect the new reign of the new king. Animals that instinctively would prey on each other will live in peace. Lions and calves, wolves and lambs, they will lie down together. It will be so peaceful and safe that little children, like we saw just this morning up here lighting the candle, little children, toddlers, will be able to stick their hand into the nest of a viper and pull it out unharmed. People and nations will rally to this new king. They will come under his banner of salvation. This is God's message of hope. There is life out of that dead stump. Well, we know, you and I, we know something Isaiah didn't know when he wrote those words. Jesus is the new king. He's the one of whom Isaiah speaks. This is the same one of whom the Apostle Paul wrote, "In the name of Jesus, every knee shall bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord." You see, Isaiah, if nothing else, was a man of hope. His writings are full of words about a glorious future that God was going to bring to his people. It doesn't matter one bit how mighty Assyria was or any other nation or what people think they are in charge, because they're not in charge. Our God reigns. Our God has a plan. Our God's running things. Great things are on the way. The response Isaiah is trying to elicit from Israel is the same response that God is seeking in you and I. Knowing the hope in the coming of Christ, in the tender shoot that comes from the stump of Jesse, we are called on, you and I, to act in hope. We are called on to live like we have embraced the hope of Christ. In a sort of crass way, we are being told by Isaiah that we got to put our money where our mouths are. It's not enough to just say or sing that we have hope. We got to live like we have hope. This is what the season of Advent's all about. It's about becoming a people of hope. Hope is part of the practical application of our faith. Maybe you know this story. I really love the prophet Jeremiah, I really do, who was a predecessor of Isaiah. And it was Jeremiah who predicted the disaster that was going to come from the people of Assyria, including the people's captivity and exile. Included in Jeremiah's message was the hope that God would bring his people home. And once again, that they would farm the land, and they would raise children, and they would prosper in Israel. But the question was raised by the prophet's writings, did Jeremiah really believe it? Was he a man truly of hope? In Jeremiah chapter 32, Jeremiah is in captivity. He's in jail, really. He's at the jail of the court of Zedekiah, the king of Judah. And God tells Jeremiah that his cousin, Hanamel, is going to come over to see Jeremiah to offer him the right to buy a parcel of land that Jeremiah's family owns. This transaction is where we get the word redemption from, by the way. The land in question is in Anatoth. Guess where Anatoth is? It's exactly where the Assyrian army is parked. They're camped out on it. Their tents and their animals, their chariots are all right on this land. It's where they're staging their siege of Jerusalem from. Buying this land is absolutely ridiculous. Because we know, right, Eva, in real estate, what matters is location, 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 right? Logically speaking, Jeremiah will likely never, ever have access to that property. I mean, can you imagine Jeremiah strolling out someday, right into the camp of the Babylonians or the Assyrians? Excuse me, this is my land, you're trespassing. You got to get off. Only a fool would buy that land. However, remember, God had said that one day Israel would come back, they would occupy the land. Vineyards would be planted, crops would be sowed, animals would be cared for. It's a message of hope, but does Jeremiah really believe it? You know what Jeremiah did? He buys the land. He acts out of hope. Not only does he buy the land, he makes a public display of the transaction. He makes sure the elders of the city, all the people of influence, see him putting his money where his mouth is. Jeremiah was asked, is there life in the old stump? If so, buy that field. Are we a people of hope? Have we seen the new shoot growing up from Jesse's stump? What are we communicating, you and I, to our friends and family and the world this Christmas season? When we look under our Christmas tree at the brightly wrapped parcels, what are we really offering our loved ones besides treasures that ultimately rust and decay? What are we offering? Can our treasures this Christmas not include some hope? Practically speaking, we might wonder what such a gift and a demonstration of hope would look like. It's a good question. The immediate answer comes down to how we respond, I think, to the crises in our lives. I really believe that. The times where we're called on to act with confidence when the enemy is camped on our doorstep. Do we offer hope when the doctor drops a devastating diagnosis on us or our loved ones? Do we trust God will provide? Or do we crumble in the light of bank and investment statements? In the very heart of a skeptical, faithless world in which we live, do we regularly demonstrate faith? Do we live as if our God reigns? When George Herbert Bush, George Bush Sr., was vice president, he was sent as the representative of the United States to the funeral of Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev. Bush was deeply moved by the silent protest that was carried out by Brezhnev's widow. She stood motionless in front of the coffin until seconds before it was closed. And then just as the soldiers touched the lid of the coffin to close it, Brezhnev's wife performed one of the greatest acts of courage and hope ever demonstrated. And what might have been accounted as one of the most profound acts of civil disobedience in the Soviet Union, she reached down to the chest of her husband and made the cross on him. There in the citadel of the secular atheistic power of the world, the wife of the man who had run it all hoped that her husband was wrong, that there was hope. She hoped that there was another life and that life was best represented by Jesus who died on the cross, and that same Jesus might yet have mercy on her husband. I don't know if you share my conclusions about this world, but I strongly believe that what this world needs more almost than anything else is hope. I really believe it. Not just wishful thinking, but active, engaged people of hope. As Hebrews 11 says, what is faith? It is the confidence, assurance that what we hope for is going to happen. It is the evidence of things we cannot see. What the world needs more is what Mrs. Brezhnev demonstrated. That despite it all, faith is present. Hope is present. And most of all, that God is present. And that being a person of hope and faith means that no one, nothing, can steal your joy. Jesus said, you will be joyful and no one shall rob you of your joy. That's in John 16:22. You know, there was another modern day prophet who captured our need for sustained hope in a very creative way. I think most of you have probably heard it. His name is Theodore Geisel, but mostly we know him as Dr. Seuss. Do you know him? And if you never read the book, The Parables of Dr. Seuss, I encourage you to pick it up. Because that particular book shows us that Geisel actually was talking about faith in all his children's stories. And every year on television, we meet one character, probably his most famous, who tries to squash the hope of the season of Christmas. And every year, he learns the same lesson. The Grinch. The Grinch learns that the hope of Christmas is much deeper than the commercial trappings of the season. The Grinch learned this. It came without ribbons. It came without tags. It came without packages, boxes, or bags. And he puzzled their hours till his puzzler was sore. And then the Grinch thought of something he hadn't before. Maybe Christmas, he thought, doesn't come from a store. Maybe Christmas, perhaps, means a little bit more. Poor Grinch didn't know what he was up against. Robert Short, who wrote the book about the parables of Dr. Seuss, makes the point that no one can steal away our joy, our hope. The Grinch saw this, and he made a wise decision, I think. What did the Grinch decide to do? He decided to join in. He decided he wanted that deeper joy, that hope. He wanted to stop following things that did not make him happy. This is the Bible strategy for sharing the good news, the hope we have in Christ. From Peter 2:12, we read, your conduct among the surrounding peoples should always be good and right, for that although they may find the usual ways to slander you as evildoers, yet when disasters come, they may glorify God when they see how well you conduct yourself. When the world sees that it cannot beat us, they'll join in. They'll want to be a part of it. What, may we ask, gives the Who's in Whosville their unconquerable love and optimism? The simple answer is Christmas. The coming of God in Jesus Christ. The coming of God that goes to any lengths, overcomes all barriers, stops at nothing to finally bring us all into the kingdom of love. Is this what you're putting under your tree? Or better yet, is this what you are cultivating in your heart? I hope so. Because a tender shoot from Jesse's stump has grown into something marvelous.